Okay, so Scott just said something that's worth repeating for people who may be surviving on tape. Availability is not limited by his office hours. If his office hours don't work, contact him for an appointment. Also, and I sent this out to the list, but there's now an alias, cs439-ta@airsos.com. Sooner or later, Hopkins will figure out how to run email, but I don't expect to survive long enough to observe it. And so that will reach Scott even when Hopkins is not cooperating. In general, the right solutions to Hopkins infrastructure is to get your own. Okay. Well, I was tempted to say to myself, oh, well, we're done with the kernel, and, you know, heave a big sigh of relief along with all of you. And then I realized it wasn't true. There's actually a major path we haven't done. And this is a path that is straightforward but complicated if I ignore two issues. The first is SMP, and the second is the problem that we're trying to support two different addressing subsystems in this architecture at the same time. Let me explain in very broad terms what's going on in this path. There are actually two essentially separate phases. The first is, by default, we have to determine if there's anything to be done at that fault. And there may not be a valid address. So there's sort of three possible outcomes. One is, we're going to go to walk the GPT structures, and we're going to discover there's no answer to the question. At that point, we're going to declare that this fault is real, and we're going to deal with it as a memory fault, in the sense that we're going to report it with a message to the memory fault handler, if any. Second possibility. We're going to start into the GPT structure, and we're going to discover that some GPT needs to be paged in. This is a fault in some sense, because there was no defined address, but we don't yet know enough to declare if it's an externally visible fault, right? Basically, we will fault in the GPT structure as long as we need to. And until we've gotten all the way to the point where there's a definitive error, it's not an error. The last possibility is we'll walk the GPT structure, and there will turn out to have been a mapping that answers the question, in which case we will install it and return. This is a place where there's some layering going on in the fault structure. The hardware mechanism is it was a page fault. But whether this was logically a page fault at the level of the Eros object system or not is something that we're going to have to determine as we go. So the basic structure of the path is to first do this memwalk thing. Memwalk is the path that walks the GPTs. It is by far, with the exception of the capability invocation path, it's the most complicated path in the system. And look, remember early on I said what's left, a microkernel is what's left when you throw out all the easy stuff? Okay, well, second statement. So what's left when you throw out all the easy stuff is something that really only does two things, right? It does IPC and it does page fault handling. So not surprising that the remaining two paths would be a little bit complicated, unfortunately. But logically, what's going to happen here is we're going to do the memwalk, which is going to walk the GPT structures. And if the memwalk comes back with anything useful, we're then going to go update the hardware structures. This is much simpler than the corresponding Eros code, which actually updated the two of them in lockstep with a coroutine kind of a scheme. And there was a reason for that, and we're not convinced that that reason was well-motivated. Part of what we're trying to do is find out. We've got to do some measuring. And maybe when we're done walking this path, I'll explain what the issue was. Part of the reason for this separation is that different pieces of hardware have very different mapping structures. So on the cold fire implementation, which we're in the middle of doing, we may elect not to have any hardware-like tables at all because it's a soft-loaded TLB. So it may be that the right answer is just run the memwalk, get the answer, load it into the TLB, declare victory, and move on. That is not the world's fastest implementation from the standpoint of performance, but it is probably the world's fastest implementation from the standpoint of getting something our clients can run and we can measure. And we don't have to stick with that implementation. Okay. So, there's also something rather perverse here that I'm noticing that I don't understand, which is we're doing all, even if the address is out of bound, we don't determine that until we've already done the memwalk, which strikes me as counterintuitive. I think that's a bug. In fact, I know that's a bug. Okay, so the memwalk process is going to tell us both whether there's a resolution And what are the permissions that resulted? Because when we're done walking the GPT tree, we'll know all of that. Separate from that, there's the question of what access did you request that led to this fault? So this might be a read-only address. You requested a write. That's a mistake. Okay. So what's going to happen here is, having run the memlock, which I will get into in a minute, also, let me explain these restrictions. So remember I said there was a notion of a weak permission, and that traversing a weak capability meant that you could not thereafter get any writable capability or any write-permitting capability? So the weak permission applies to metadata. It doesn't apply to leaf structure. If I traverse a GPT that has a weak restriction, I can't get anything writable below that. But if I get all the way to the bottom and there's a capability page at the bottom, a weak restriction doesn't apply there. And that's why we have this different restriction notion. I got that wrong. I'm sorry. Okay, the upper mask is saying, what restrictions are we actually caring about when we're walking the GPTs? Well, the answer is we're interested in read-only weak, and if it's supported by the hardware, we're going to honor the no-execute restriction. Not supported by the hardware, we're going to ignore it. And then in the leaf capabilities, I actually had to take some of those bits back in order to describe cacheability constraints. Now, there are some bits that exist that have different meanings on page capabilities than they do on GPT capabilities. So this story about weak was just wrong. We do the memlock, which we're doing too early because we ought to do this address validity check earlier. And then afterwards we say, well, if the address that we were asked to traverse was out of range, it doesn't count. How could that be? Well, maybe you asked us to resolve address that fell within the kernel virtual range. This check, by the way, is naive because we're going to need a system call page that's supplied by the kernel, and so that's going to have to be handled as a special case. If you wanted execute permission and the walk didn't support execute permission, sorry, you don't get it. And all these things that say go to deliver fault, these are all the cases where we're going to bail out and complain to somebody. Okay? Of course, the other possibility, and by the way, I'm not clear why this one gets cherry-picked, because if we already got a result from the memwalk, I'm not clear why we shouldn't be delivering that. Okay. So another possibility is a reference compatibility issue. If you did a capability load, and what we got at the bottom was a data page, you can't do that. Because if we allowed that to proceed, it would give you enough authority to take bits and convert them into a capability, and that we don't want. Conversely, if you wanted a capability, there's a dual test here. I'm wondering why it's not there. You did want a capability. I got to ask some questions about this path. This is great, because this is a path that was done by Jonathan Adams, and I haven't yet had a chance to review it. So here we are doing it live. I bet he didn't know he was going to be subject to public review. He was warned. Okay, let me explain what comes out of the memoir process. First, let me point out a problem in the... It's either a problem in the specification or in the implementation, depending on your point of view, of GPTs, which is that I can have a GPT which, by some number of levels of indirection, involves a cyclic traversal. And if I were to follow that path indefinitely, that would be wrong. And the particularly nasty one is if all of the cycles proceed through slot zero, because I'll start chopping off pieces of the address. And as I chop them off, I zero them. The problem is that the zeros will continue to proceed down this loop forever. This is not usually the desired outcome. And so we set an arbitrarily chosen architectural bound on the number of traversal steps that we will attempt. We can't get a valid translation, and it's set large, intentionally. We've never actually observed anybody to hit it. If we can't get a valid translation in that number of steps, then by fiat, there is no valid translation. Work around this cycle problem. The memwalk exercise produces is a vector. It says, at each traversal, what information did we gather and what object were we going through? And it also keeps a set of cumulative results. So we know, coming out of memwalk, both the final permissions that we got at the end of the walk and also the permissions at each step. Do you ever have big questions? I'm just curious.
Actually, you don't understand why particular level of translation should translate 0 bits. I didn't understand why a particular level of translation should translate 0 bits.
Stop the issue. No, that's a parse error.
Okay.
Translating bits which are zeros is translating no.
Well, actually, we could have both cases.
But I want to make sure that we.
Okay.
We get the right parsing.
Right. So suppose I have an address, just to sort of go back through this, right? And I have some bits in the address that I care about, and here's the L2V of the GPT that I'm going through. Well, after I go through that GPT successfully, all these bits are logically zero because they have been translated. The problem is the specification allows me to proceed into a larger subspace, a child of a smaller subspace. And if that happens, what's going to happen is I'm going to revisit these bits that are now zero. And I will use them again, translating in the smaller, in the larger subspace. Well, if there's a loop in the space structure, I can do this indefinitely, unless there's something to stop me. Can I answer your question?
So if you're going into a larger space, I thought you have either fewer bits or more bits. Like,
could have the same number of bits.
Isn't it the same space?
Necessarily. Go through the exercise of constructing a space in which you have two GPTs, one above the other, that have the same L2V value. And the bottom one of the two has no useful guard value.
Guard is definitive.
What?
The.
Forget the guard. The guard has nothing to do with this. Okay. But what I believe you will conclude is that in the absence of a bound, that you can construct. Actually, I think you can do it in one GPT, but I know you can do it in two. That you can construct an infinite loop in the translation. And so here's the deal. The reason this is not possible in hardware translation systems is there's a requirement that each progressive layer be a smaller space. Given that we were doing a software translated systems, there were reasons not to do that. There are various bounds you could impose, and we've chosen a traversal bound, but that's not the only one you could use. So what comes out of the memwalk function is essentially a vector which says at each step what information did we gather, and then also an accumulated answer. And the reason we want that is because we need the partial information so that we will be able to share page tables, for example. So what happens below here is, assuming we've got a valid translation, and if we make it here, we've got a valid translation. Now we're going to go and set up the hardware page tables to match this translation. Figure out which part I want. I think I want to do memwalk first. Sorry, Brian.
Do you need a fixed?
Okay. Well, no. This particular algorithm is an iterative algorithm, not a recursive algorithm. So, in fact, the answer is no. But we do have a bound on the vector size that the memwalk entry wants to return, because that's a hard-coded bound.
So you have a fixed. Vector can only be so big.
I mean, we could choose an arbitrary size for it, but for any given size, it's only so big, right?
Right. And so once you fix that size, it...
Yes, although as a practical matter, it's the other way around. We choose the bound, and that determines the vector size. Okay, so I think the main message of this path is options are bad for your health. But basically, what's going to happen here is we're going to come in at the top with a capability that points to the address space slot of some process. Actually, a capability pointer, excuse me. An address that we are trying to resolve with respect to that address space. A Boolean that tells us whether this was read or write. And a out parameter, which is this memwalk results parameter, which generally is going to live on the stack of our caller in most cases. And we're going to just do the traversal. There's nothing hugely complicated here. So the index is basically telling us how many steps have we done, right? There's your bound right there. We have to prepare each capability as we traverse it. That by now should look familiar. Now, there's an optimization here, which is that we know, so we're betting, we're making a bet. The bet we're making is that the space is well-formed, because if the space is malformed, it really doesn't matter very much that we identify that aggressively. We need to do it reasonably fast, but we don't have to optimize the case of the malformed space because the process isn't going to make any progress in that case anyway. But if the space is well-formed, it's going to take the form of a chain of GPTs down to some leaf, and that leaf will be either a page capability a capability page capability, a null capability, or a window capability. For registerization reasons, we have a loop within a loop where the inner loop is trying to traverse GPTs. In fact, this would work, I think, if we just took that loop out. And I think the original version didn't have it. So as long as we're looking at a GPT capability, you know, I'm completely convinced that that's wrong, too. Well, it's not. All right. So we need to get the L2 gene. Why? That tells us where the guard starts. Okay. And we're going to fetch out the guard value, right? Extract the high bits out of the address and compare them to the guard. If they don't match, this is an invalid address and we're done. Right? That's the guard check right there. Assuming that they do match, we are going to incorrectly take them out of the address. The reason I say incorrectly is because if the guard value is zero, I need to think about whether that's correct. I don't think it is. The reason I don't think it is, okay, suppose the guard value and the address are both zero in the relevant bits. What we're now doing is XORing zero with zero. No, in this particular case, this will actually work correctly. Okay. So the remaining address is going to be what we're left with after we take out the guard. So at each step, we're figuring out both what was the address coming in and also what was the residual address going out. And having done that, we're now going to actually look at the GPT itself. We've now consumed the guard. If this GPT has a background space, which is something I haven't talked about, we're going to record about it. We're going to record that fact on the way by. I haven't really talked about the background space mechanism, so let me bypass that for now. Now we've got to figure out what the slot is. Well, what's the slot? We've already taken out the guard, so the slot is those bits that are above the L2V value for this GPT. Right? What we're doing here is basically figuring out what is the index component that we're going to use to index into this software page table. If the slot's too big to fit, it ain't right. And we're done. Otherwise, what we have to do is basically take that component out of the address, because once we consume these bits to index in the GPT, they're gone. We don't want them anymore. Now we have a little bit of a tricky bit, because we've got to trace a bunch of this stuff. Remember I said we're going to record information at each level? So here we are doing it. So at each level, we're going to record what was the L2G we had, what was the entry that we went through, what was the slot we went through, what restrictions applied at that slot, or actually in this case, what restrictions applied at this GPT. There's something counterintuitive here. Oh, my mistake. Okay. And then we're going to keep track of the cumulative restrictions. We're going to bump the index. And now if the index has gone too far, we're done. No resolution. Otherwise, we're going to fetch out the capability from the slot, and we're going to iterate on that. Somewhere at the end of this, we're more or less going to get to something that's not a GPT. And at this point, because of the background space mechanism, there's some complication. And I'm going to ignore that for a moment and go through the quote simple unquote case. But here again, we're going to check the guard value. And it turns out that for those capabilities that are not memory objects, he's doing the type dispatch late. Okay, so this is essentially doing the guard logic to fetch the guard as if this were going to be a memory capability, which is the high likelihood outcome. But notice he hasn't done the type check to make sure that that's the case. Having done all the work to extract the guard, right, he then actually only checks the guard for those capabilities that have one. The type check's being done, it's just being done in nominally the wrong order. Okay, again, we're going to take the guard out of the address, assuming you've had one. And now, however, we're going to have to look at the capability type. And there starts to be some case analysis. If it's a page or if it's a cap page, then we ought to be done. And we've got a success in the sense that there is a well-defined translation. That does not mean that it's the translation you want. It is well-defined. It could be something called a local window capability, which I'm not going to get into. A background window capability, which I'm not going to get into. Or it could be another GPT. Now, this case is a little perverse because If we manage to get a GPT in here, that means that we exited the upper loop, and if we exited the upper loop, we ought not to be here with the GPT capabilities, so this shouldn't happen. So, and then there are basically a number of excuses for why we could be exiting. The options being, well, we had an invalid address, we had a malformed space, or we succeeded. In the sense that we have a well-defined translation that may not be what you want. So basically what we've done, oh, and then at the bottom, we do a last-minute check for whether you were attempting to write and we did not have sufficient permission for that. If we don't have a well-defined translation, it doesn't matter whether the permission is matched. There is a sort of failure of specification in that the specification does not say what order the exceptions came out in. So for example, suppose you asked for write. Somewhere along the way, there's a read-only capability. And somewhere below that, there's a slot that's malformed. Should we return a malformed space exception, or should we return an access violation? The answer is, I don't know. And it probably doesn't matter very much. And the specification is sloppy about this, and it needs to be tightened up. This is one of these cases where we're going to let the implementation drive the specification. Unless it turns out to be a good reason not to do so. But the main output of this is that cumulative restriction, the success result, and the population of these entries. But notice at this point, we've not yet done anything that will update any hardware table anywhere. We've just done the walk on the software structure. Right, so go back over to page vault, because this routine is quasi-generic. If you actually were to go back and look at the invocation path, you would discover that this routine gets called whenever you fetch a capability from memory in the invocation path. Right? It's used to locate the capability page that holds that capability. Also called whenever you're doing a string copy. It's used to find the pages that are participating in the string copy. So this translation path gets called, and one distinction between this path and the corresponding Unix path, Unix doesn't really have an IPC operation. It has things like pipes. Pipes are a little funny because at least logically, there's always a buffering step in a pipe. Now the current Linux implementation optimizes that out in some cases, but in principle, it is a valid implementation. Always copy into the buffer in one step and then copy out in a separate step. One of the properties about that, which was an intentional property of the Unix design, is that there's never any case where you're translating an address in some address space other than the current process space. Kyoto's and Eros and all the systems that do IPC, you always have these cross-space cases because there's no buffer. So now we've got a set of entries and we have to build a set of corresponding page tables. And this is a pain in the ass because depending on which hardware system we're on, we may have two levels or three. And the path has to be a little bit genericized. And unfortunately, when you make a path like this generic, it ceases to be straightforward. Okay, so let me explain how that was done just so you'll get an intuition about what the heck's going on here. See this page table level structure? Notice that in the upper one, there's a canary value at the end, which is zero, which says we're done. But ignoring the canary value, you'll see the upper one has three and the lower one has two. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to walk this structure to tell us what tables we're looking at and how big they are. And when we hit the bottom, that's how we know that we're done. So if we're going to be walking a PAE structure, we're going to be looking at this table. And if we're going to be walking a legacy structure, we're going to be looking at this table. And that initialization happens here. If we're using PAE, we're going to grab one table. Otherwise, we're going to grab the other one. Now, the top-level pointer in the hardware system, there's a problem that it doesn't implement permission bits. So the master address space pointer in the Pentium does not have a read-only bit, for example. And so if we need read-only at the top level, which can happen under obscure conditions, we need to achieve that by forcing all of the bits in the table below us to be read-only. So if we don't have the bit at a given level, we solve the problem by pushing that bit down to the next level in all slots. So, right. So what we're going to do here is we're going to say, if we have any restrictions to deal with at the very top level, right, which is the ones that we got in the very first walk entry, it's not sufficient to just get any page table. We have to find a page table with matching restrictions. And if no such page table exists, a page table get will cause it to exist, I believe. Okay. It causes it to exist. we have to make sure that there's an association between this page table and its process, because we need to be able to invalidate it if anything in this page table changes. And boom, now we're going to start traversing. And this for loop is iterating over those tables. Remember before we initialized curPT to point to one of the tables or the other? We're now iterating over the entries in the table. That's how we're going to work this out. And okay, now we get to the canary PTE. Well, okay. The find PTE is not complicated. It's just doing an indexed lookup into the page table. The only reason there's a procedure here is indexing rules depend on which style of table you're using. In fact, it's very unfortunate that there needs to be a procedure here. Canary PTE, okay. Suppose I have two CPUs, both running processes that are attempting to satisfy address faults on a shared address space. And they both hit the same address at the same time, or they hit closely related addresses. The key requirement is that at some point they're traversing the same page table entry, whether it's at an upper level or at a lower level. Each of them goes and does a memwalk independent of the other and gets a valid translation. Now each of them is starting to update the page table structure. What we don't want to do is have one of them clobber the work of the other. So what we need to do here is set up a page table entry that basically marks the fact that work is in progress to produce this entry. We're going to do that with an atomic update. One of these candidate processes will succeed at writing this special marker page table entry, which we call a canary. Another one will notice the canary and say, oh, I got to back off. What's actually going to happen is we're going to do the notice late. We will plant the canary. We will proceed to figure out what to do. At the end, we will go to rewrite the page table entry to the one that we actually want. But we will only do that right if the canary marker is still there. The canary marker is not there. That means somebody else wrote the entry while we were in progress. In which case, what we are going to do is we are going to back all the way out of this mess and start over. Because there's some likelihood that the address we cared about has already been defined, or at least partially defined. Interesting race in the SMP system to do this. I'm not 100% convinced we did it right. So the behavior of canary PTE is essentially to write the canary marker, right, and it will not, there's a canary bit that it says, or the software defined bits. So there's a notion of producer, how to deal with the producer. It would be much simpler if we didn't care about performance. That's true in more contexts than I care to think about. If we didn't care about performance, then we would not attempt to share any page table entries. And if we didn't want to share any page tables. And if we didn't want to share any page tables, there's a whole bunch of logic we wouldn't have to do here. Turns out that sharing page tables matters a lot. It changes the speed of starting up the second copy of the same process by a factor of about 1,000 by real measure. There's some real strong incentive to want to share these things. But we have a notion of something called a producer. For every page table, there is some unique GPT you can point to and say, if it were not for that GPT, this page table could not exist. And generally speaking, it is the lowest GPT, it's the highest GPT that contributes anything to the state of that page table. That's the producer. If you were to go above that in the tree, you'd be impacting some entry in the next table up. And if you were to go below that in the tree, ignoring this candidate GPT, you'd have some bits that were not getting considered yet to figure out what was going on. There's always some GPT that you can figure out, if that guy weren't here, I wouldn't know what page table I was in. That's the producer. Hanging off of that guy will be a linked list of all the page tables that were produced by that GPT. The way we're going to share our page tables is we're going to find a producer and we're going to walk that list. And the reason we might have multiple tables is there are a couple of reasons. One, we might have different restrictions that apply. One might be read-only, another one might be read-write. Two, we can actually find that GPT appearing at different dynamic heights in the tree, because we could have two in-pointers to it that have different incoming constraints. And that can require us to build different page tables for it. So the upshot of it is, we're going to find the producer, and we've now got all of the information out of the memwalk entry that we need to have to generate the correct page table entry, assuming we have the page table. And what we're going to do is build that entry. And I'm not going to try to go through all of the disgusting, laborious detail of doing that, because it would not be rational to do that to you. Okay, our little nod to Fantasy Island here, which went off the air before most of you were born. If we've gotten all the way to the end, then we should have translated far enough that what's left is merely the page index bits. Okay? And if that's the case, we have to do the leaf insertion, so the bottom level page table entry points to the page we want. In contrast to the GPT, where we have to go allocate page tables and find them, the bottom level page is an identically shared structure, so we have to actually set up a pointer to the correct page. And most of the effort you're seeing here is, let's just see if I can find a good example. Okay, you see this rm install pte mapping? That's actually the other important part of what's going on here. If we install a forward mapping from a page table entry to a page, and later the page goes away, for example, it gets destroyed, or we want to page it out, or we have to mark a copy on write because we're doing a checkpoint, we need to be able to find all the page table entries that point to it and downgrade them to read-only state. And there are a variety of obscenely clever, that's a four-letter word, tricks we could use to propagate some of that. But in some cases, we really just have to find them and whack them. And one unfortunate property of this kind of design is not generally true about the Linux design, so let me contrast these. If I'm trying to invalidate a page in Linux, it'll turn out that there is one unique memory structure that owns that page. And if I invalidate it in that unique memory structure, I've gotten it everywhere. The reason for this is that in Linux, this may not be quite true. Okay, so in Linux, all of the writable mappings are either fully private, in which case they only appear in one address space, and there's really only one place to invalidate them, or they're fully shared. And ignoring some funny cases that can arise with mmap, in the overwhelming majority of cases where they're shared at the same virtual address in all processes. The unit of sharing is a particular memory abstraction that's larger than a page. It's basically the data structure produced by an mmap. So every dirty page is uniquely owned by one of these mapping structures. So the page structure gets me back to the mapping structure, and then the mapping structure knows all of the virtual addresses at which it is mapped, and now I know all the places that I have to whack. Because of this curious set of relations, and in most cases, one virtual address will do it. Because of this, for most purposes, I do not need an inverted page table with Linux. I don't need anything that will get me from a page address back to all possible mapping addresses. Eros has a richer mapping structure because there is no unique back pointer from a page to its owning data structure. We have an arbitrary number of GPTs that contain the same page capability. So we need a reverse mapping. It's also the case in Linux, by the way, that all of the reasons that you could have to remove a page happen as a consequence of a system call that walks the structures top down. So if I'm going to page out a page, even that, if you go look at the paging algorithm in Linux, you'll discover that it actually walks these structures top down. And so it's already done enough walk to have context to know what things it's got to invalidate by the time it gets down to the page. This, by the way, actually leads to some fairness issues in the Linux paging model that are unfortunate. In Coyotes and in Eros, the ager does not care who's been touching the page. It does not do this walk top down. It walks the list of pages in an age-based order. The oldest page loses, period, full stop. This is actually the strategy you want. Linux is doing an approximate LRU. A very approximate. Of course, if you're going to implement that, you need to be able to walk the structure backwards, and so you need a reverse map. Furthermore, Linux does not have any operation analogous to destroying an object. Objects are basically destroyed on last reference, lost. Of course, if there are no references to an object, you know there's nothing to clean up. You should zero the state of the object so you don't leak data, but when the last reference is gone, the mappings are already gone. In our case, we can destroy an object that is currently actively mapped, and we have to be able to clean up those mappings. So there's a reverse mapping data structure. You'll occasionally hear us refer to this as PTE-1. And there's a second data structure called the depend structure. And let's see if I can find one of those getting set up. This must be done in here. Where is it?
469.
Which file? Okay. Fennis, all right, okay. So what's going on here is that there are two data structures that are collectively, that are in combination, manage the dependency information. One of them is essentially a downward data structure, and the other one is an upward data structure. The downward data structure solves the following, in abstract, solves the following problem. We're going to cheat, but let me give you the idea first. If I overwrite a slot of a GPT, I need to know all the page tables that have to be eradicated in order for that overwrite to be saved. That's what the depend table tracks. It tracks the forward dependency, and it's got a truly disgusting set of relationships for optimizing that data structure. Basically, it says for each GPT, there is a corresponding known to be contiguous set of page table entries that that GPT has some involvement with. And there's a set of slots in the GPT, there's a bitmap for which slots are active, and there's a known relationship between the power of two offset of the GPT and the power of two offset of the first PTE that it impacts. And there's a set of combination rules that are more complicated than I want to try to explain so that we don't have an excessive number of depend entries. It is possible for a single GPT, because it produces multiple page tables, it's possible for a single GPT to produce multiple depend entries. The other table manages reverse mappings. So that's the one that says, if I have a page, this table will tell me all the page table entries that point to that page. It turns out if we were to fully utilize both of those data structures naively, we would get excessive depend entries. And it also turns out that in most cases, just because of the way the data structures fall out, it often turns out that a GPT that is, well, if a GPT is a producer of a page table, it turns out that the reverse map encodes most of what you need to know. And so in that case, we may not build an additional depend entry. There are these two data structures that are tracking relationships. Remember early on I said that the software data structure is definitive and the hardware data structure basically is a dynamic attempt to, there's a tree correspondence in the hardware structure. In response to faults, we're adding information to the hardware structure. The requirement is that the permissions in the hardware structure should never exceed the permissions in the software structure. These are the tables that are helping to enforce that requirement. The constructive case is the page fault path, and that guarantees that we never put more permission in than is currently in the software structure. And the deconstructive case is handled by these tracking data structures. If we were to go look at the GPT write slot operation in the appropriate cat file, why don't we do that? Okay, well actually setLTV is a good one too, because, and I bet we got this wrong. So you notice if we change the L2V, we've changed the basis assumption of any mapping that was built from this GPT. And notice there's a call to memheader invalidate cache state. That has the effect of whacking all the page table entries that have been built from this GPT. Because if we change the L2V, we're changing where it cuts the address for mapping purposes. And whatever we built before, I promise you it doesn't make any sense now. The offset relationships have changed. Erase has a similar effect. Okay, get slot should not be a problem, but set slot, right? Somewhere in here, unless we screwed up, which wouldn't be the first time, depend invalidate slot. They're at 320, right? So that's saying we're clobbering a particular slot of a GPT, and we better make sure that all the dependencies in that slot get whacked. And this would be less complicated, except that there's this background space that I keep saying I'm not going to talk about that complicates the story. Let me just give you an intuition. There's something called a window capability. It says, aha, if you want to know what happens below this point, back up to the nearest enclosing background space and walk this other address down that space. Actually, the foreground space has a window onto the background space. And there are some congruency requirements about the window and its background that allow us to preserve correctness in the dependency structure. But the result of that is that we can have some very peculiar dependency relationships. So one thing I would like you to do is to take a look at the memwalk structure and the do page fault routine. If you can get your head around what's going on. And for the moment, ignore the dependency tracking stuff. That's a sort of secondary issue. And there's a bunch of algebraic correlations that are why that stuff works that are not adequately documented in the code at this point. Ignore that stuff. get the idea of how that stuff works. Maybe a little too much to ask with Thanksgiving coming up and this project assignment coming up. I'm asking it anyway because we've had it easy for the last several weeks. Okay, so I'm going to stop at this point. Before I let everybody go, let me ask, do you have questions anticipating the project? And let me tell you, for those of you who haven't caught up with it, let me tell you what the project is. It's the one that I promised, which is the pipe implementation. Pipe is conceptually very simple. It's got an input channel, an input stream, an output stream, and it's got a buffer. And at this point, hopefully, you guys know how to implement a stream capability in Abstract. Although this one can block, and that requires some added complexity that null and zero stream did not require. And there's an issue of remembering, you know, how much the buffer is full and how much remaining space there is in it. And that changes the blocking behavior, so there's some interaction. But at least, loosely speaking, this is something approximating the Unix-style pipe. The other complication, and this is sort of a noise-level complication, but it will trip people up. When I create a pipe object, I don't get back a stream. I get back a pipe capability. I then have to ask that for the input stream and the output stream. And the only reason for that is that the return protocol does not allow me to return two capabilities as an answer to the construct operation. And there are a couple of ways to weasel out of that. This one's probably the simplest. So there's a little bit of added complexity there that you're going to have to keep track of which endpoint is which so you know whether the party calling you is calling on the input stream or on the output stream. You're going to have to set endpoint IDs, and you're going to have to create new endpoints. Any other question there?
Excuse me.
It's okay.
You had mentioned earlier in a previous lecture a location in the Kaitos environment where developers can safely place their own application. Was that?
There isn't enough of a model there to use
it. I thought you said something.
No. I don't want to get into that because that requires setting up a bunch of makefile structure that isn't well documented. If I had a demo tree, maybe I should solve it by putting up a demo tree. And in fact, I have to do that anyway. So if I had a demo tree, I would say, look, just copy this tree, change its name, and check it in. In this case, I think just doing it, you know, somewhere in the existing tree is probably a better path.
Okay.
Any questions about this before we break? Week from Friday of next week. Given that Scott's office hours this week fall on Thanksgiving, it didn't seem appropriate to make it Friday of this week. And Scott's going to, as he said, make office hours available on Monday. In principle, this shouldn't be a hard assignment. The complication should come from dealing with the producer-consumer issues. And given that this is a 400-level course in systems, that shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, although I know some of you are coming in without OS background. Get to Scott. Take the time to figure out the structure of what you're trying to do, and figure out how you get yourself confused by Monday so you can go ask productive questions if that's the path that's going to work for you. And take a look at the existing null stream and zero stream. The reference implementations are now there, and you can look at, oh, yes, very important thing that I should send out an email, but let me get it out before I forget. I do not recommend doing this assignment by continuing to edit on your current tree. What I would do is take the, you all hopefully now have a Kaitos tree in /home, okay? And I will send this out by email. What I would like you to do is rename that tree, okay, from Kaitos to nullstream.kaitos. Don't throw it away because I still need to clone it so that we can grade the old assignment. Move it aside, check out a new tree. I really wish you hadn't done that. Especially since it almost certainly resulted in conflicts. Might still be okay depending on what directory your implementation was in. Let's move it aside. We'll figure it out if it's a problem. Another thing, and this is stated, buried in the project description, you don't need to do the read and write operations. Those exist in the library. And if you look at them, that'll give you a clue to how to deal with blocking. There's one complication in this assignment that I reserve the right to remove. Is this issue of why things are really much simpler if the pipe buffer is at least twice the size of the write limit and the read limit. And I am torn in two directions in terms of hints. The first approach says, look, do this, just assume the buffer size is always going to be at least twice the operation size, forget about that issue, do the simple version, and then go back and think about it. And if you're having trouble with getting any of this stuff working, that's probably the right approach to do first, because at least then something is working. The other approach is to think that issue through before you try to tackle this, because that's where all the bodies are buried in a producer-consumer system. And it's hard to know which way to advise you. I guess I think that the sort of simple, obvious system... So the problem with doing the simple, obvious system, just ignoring that issue at the first, is that you'll end up throwing a fair bit of it away. On the other hand, I mean, you won't throw away the boilerplate, right? You'll have to rework a good bit of your producer-consumer code to deal with that issue. On the other hand, at least by then, you'll have producer-consumer code that's working that you can test, and then it's a matter of tuning your test and re-engineering it to deal with this corner case. And the corner case is sticky. So even though it involves some rework, I think I advocate doing the simpler one first. I have something working and nothing working. I will mail that point out. Are there other questions? Okay, in that case, notwithstanding that I handed you this present to hang over you over the holiday, try to enjoy your Thanksgiving.